All right, good morning, everybody. It's 9 o'clock, so we're going to go ahead and get started with lesson 118, the Stamp GBC Controversy, Part 2. Last Sunday, we started looking at the steps. Remember, we studied in, 1968, Stamp wrote The Present Peril, and he included statements in there about how in 1966, they adopted this resolution at the Berean Bible Society against neo-evangelicalism. And then in August 1968, Stamp published Silence Now Would Be Sin, in which he formally leaves the KGF, and he references this two-year behind-the-scenes struggle. And so what we started last week was to look at the nature of what that struggle was and what the issues were, okay? And what we've seen a couple of things. First, we saw in 1964, in the Journal of Grace Theology, there was an article by a guy named Aronson, and I think I'm spelling this right, that advocated for the reading the literature of D.H. Lawrence and so on. Okay, Stamp took exception to that. Then we saw in the spring of 1966, there's this, I'll call it Spirit of Arianism by Weddle, that we started looking at. It's an article, again, that appeared in the Journal of Grace Theology in the spring issue 1966. Where we were last Sunday is we spent the majority of our time looking at this article, what was in it, and what Stamp would have found objectionable within that article, okay? And then at the end of the hour last time, we started making some, we started looking at what some motives might be, and some things came up about why didn't Stamp respond with a letter to the editor and so forth in the journal, and there were a few things that we discussed at the end. So if you look at today, we are still in 1966. So we're looking at the major events still that of this controversy that were occurring within 1966. And I just want to stress again that this is compiled from actually having read the letters, the primary correspondence back and forth between these guys that were involved in it. I'm not suggesting that the letters that I've seen are a complete, exhaustive collection of everything that was said back and forth. In fact, I'm very certain that it's not. But it's probably the most complete collection of this correspondence that one could have access to, particularly now in 2013. So, July 28, 1966, Jeff Farrell addresses a letter to Charles Baker. Okay? So, on July 28, 1966, Jeff L. Farrell addressed a personal letter to Charles F. Baker, then president. We don't need the there. Then president of GBC, outlining his concerns regarding the school. In hindsight, Dr. Dale S. DeWitt described the Farrell letter as the first shot across the bow in the controversies that rocked the college in the late 60s and early 70s. So from DeWitt's perspective, having lived through this, he says that this letter from Farrell to Mr. Baker was sort of the first siren going off that there's trouble here, okay? That trouble's coming and there's going to be controversy. Now, think of the timing here. So this is the spring 66. You've got this article, Spirit of Arianism by Weddle. Now we're in July 66. Farrell begins his letter by thanking Baker for taking the time to, quote, talk with those who voice concerns about GBC at the GGF convention. The Grace History Project takes this to mean at some point in the immediate past, Farrell and others had discussed some of the matters addressed in the letter with Baker at the GGF convention earlier within the summer of 66. After thanking Baker for his excellence in the presentation of the gospel of the grace of God, Farrell begins to share his concerns regarding the college. Farrell goes on to list 12 concerns. Okay, now I've summarized them. Craig? Farrell was the pastor of a church on the southeastern side of Chicago during the late 60s, and I can't remember if the church was in Lombard, Illinois, or what city it was in. Do you know that? Is it Lombard?
Lombard.
Okay, that's what I thought. So he's a pastor. He's a GGF pastor. So he identifies 12 issues. Now, I've summarized them, okay? I've tried to keep this as brief as I could, yet give you the gist of what's going on, okay? The first issue are issues related to the Bible. A statement made by Mr. Dale DeWitt at the 1966 GGF convention that the RSV is linguistically a better translation than the AV, made by expert linguists and historians, and taken from a superior Greek text. So the Bible issue does factor in to some degree. The controversy over Bible translation is one of the concerns that Farrell has with what's going on at GBC. Second, and I say allegedly, because he makes this statement, a statement made by John T. Dean, which again is Jack Dean, the acting president of GBC, that he is not a fundamentalist and did not wish to be classified as one. Third, allegedly, Pickett, who was a faculty member at the time, has stated that he is a, quote, liberal socialist. Now, I have allegedly here because in the letter he says, we've heard this. We've heard this and we've heard that. The first one he says we've heard about Dean, and the second one he says we've heard about Pickett, who was another faculty member at the time. The fourth concern he raises is spiritual condition. And it reports that the spiritual condition of some students was lower when they left, was lower than when they left home for the college. So in other words, there were reports circulating that spiritual welfare of some of the student body was degraded after leaving the school compared to where these students were at spiritually when they entered the school. Okay, so that's another one of the points that Weddle is raising. The fifth is related to a Catholic wedding. The open participation of students at a marriage of one of the female students in a Catholic church, after which alcoholic beverages were served at the reception. So one of the students got married, the wedding took place in the Catholic church that he objects to, and then there were alcoholic beverages and stuff served at the wedding, at the reception, and there were students from the college that were there taking part in this. Sixth, lack of discipline / liberal arts school. Farrell had conversed with students from the college who gave him the impression that little discipline was being enforced upon the student body and that the greater emphasis was being placed on a liberal arts school than a Bible college. These students also reported to Farrell that, quote, intellectualism was being promoted by some members of the faculty. I lost count here. I believe this is seven, right? Factions in the Grace Movement, the seventh thing that he cites. Farrell reports having interviewed a recent graduate of GBC who also pastors a Grace church who did not wish to be known as a fundamentalist. Farrell describes this person as intellectually immersed, believing that, quote, truth can be found in error, that there is truth in novels written by infidels, and that there are two factions in the, quote, Grace Movement, i.e. the intellectual for which he stands and the fundamental for which I stand, end quote. These two factions cannot coexist, and this young preacher was committed to driving fundamentalism from the Grace Movement, according to Farrell. Okay, so these are, again, understand, these are the accusations that he's making in his letter. Spirit of Bereanism. Farrell also lists Weddle's article among his list of concerns. After quoting extensively from Weddle's article, Farrell concludes this point by stating, quote, all of these are taken from an article in a publication sponsored by Grace Bible College, of which you are the president. Okay, so he's, you know, sort of yelling at him there. Emotionalism. Another reason. Farrell asserts that some faculty members have been making, quote, light of spirituality by equating it with emotionalism. The gospel blimp. The 12th item listed by Farrell is an editorial by Dean in May 1966 issue of Truth, in which he recommends that members of the GGF purchase and read the gospel blimp by Joseph Daly. Farrell objected on grounds that Daly was promoting the tactics of the new evangelicalism. After assuring Baker that his list was merely a small sample of the information he had in his possession, Farrell besought Baker to stop the spread of new evangelicalism and intellectualism at GBC. Farrell goes on to state that he could no longer support the college, either financially or publicly, noting that there were young people within his assembly that were of college age and he could not in good conscience recommend that they attend GBC. Farrell concludes his letter stating that he would continue to pray for Mr. Baker and GBC. So, this is a sort of declaration. This is the first criticism that's made that's going to be followed up by other criticisms that are going to come later. Okay. Now, I think we need to point a few things out here. Number one, Farrell is in the Chicagoland area. At this point, Mr. Stamm and the Green Bible Society are located in the city of Chicago. I don't think for a second that the two men were not communicating and discussing these things before Farrell addressed the letter to Baker. Okay? There's no doubt in my mind that the two of them had been, you know, discussing, powwowing, having meetings, or whatever you want to call it, to, you know, decide what the key issues were that they were the most upset about. And I'm not suggesting that Stamm incited Farrell to do it, but I am suggesting that the two of them were no doubt communicating back and forth about what they thought the issues were. Okay? And I want to point out that some of these, I don't know what you make of these, and it's not my intention here. Again, I want to say this again for the record. It's not my intention here to be an apologist for Mr. Stamm or GBC. Okay? Right now what I'm trying to do is just tell you what happened here and try to understand what the dynamics were and what was going on. All right. So if you look at this, the alleged statements, the Catholic wedding, some of these things just seem to be secondary and possibly irrelevant to various aspects of what's going on. They don't seem to me to be... It's not as though the... And this is a hard thing for me, because if you remember when the school was first started way back when it was Milwaukee Bible College, Stamm was the dean of students. So Stamm himself was the one that had to deal with disciplining these college-age students. Now look, unless you're going to chain them to their bed, it's not as though that the administration of the school can have 100% control and an eye on these people everywhere they go, no matter what they do. So some of the things that Farrell brings up, I think, are petty, I guess, for lack of a better term. Okay. Now, there are mixed in here some more serious-minded things, objecting to the spirit of Bereanism, objecting to, you know, the incursion of new evangelicalism and some of the other things. So there's sort of a mix here, and you know how people are. If they're going to make an argument against somebody, they typically have a few legitimate points. And then they bring other things to it to try to seemingly bolster whatever it is they're trying to, you know, put forth or whatever, and they're not always necessarily relevant at all. They may be in their own mind, they may see connections, but again, that's my perception. I'm perfectly willing to entertain any thoughts or comments that you have after reading the summary of the Farrell letter. You need to understand, though, that the Farrell letter is the first warning that there's trouble afoot here over things that are going on. Okay? Any response or comments about this section? Mike and then Mike.
I just got a little question here. You got John Dean as the acting president, and you got up here on top that Charles Baker is the president.
That was a strange time. Charles Baker is technically on administrative leave to write his book, A Dispensational Theology, and Jack Dean is the acting president at the time. So there's sort of a co-presidentship there going on as a transition is going to be made. In 68, Dean becomes second president of the school. Okay, so that's why that second president. Baker was the first.
Oh, the second president.
The second official.
Not two at a time.
No, not... Yeah, right. So it's a good point. There's a little bit of... Because of what's going on, Baker's on a sabbatical during this time to write a dispensational theology, and Dean is active president. In 68, Dean is going to become the official second president of the school, and Baker thereon will be known as President Emeritus. Okay? Mike?
Oh, I think you're absolutely correct that a lot of this stuff is petty and secondary, but others of it is very serious. A good example is the Gospel Blimp, and that should be Joseph Daly. That book was very popular at that time. It's just a small little book.
Did I spell it wrong?
Well, you got, it says Daly, but I think his name is Bailey.
Oh,
and he later became a columnist in the Eternity magazine. But it's a humorous little book. I think it was a giveaway book by the Billy Graham Association. It was very popular at the time. It's a small book, and it just shows the foibles that Christians have and problems they have sometimes witnessing to others, and how imperfect and how to correct it, to do evangelism.
From your perspective, was there anything wrong with that book, The Gospel Blimp?
No, not really.
Okay.
If you read the book in its context, no.
Okay, Lee?
There was a movie made by that called The Gospel Blimp. It's still available. Gospel Films is the one that made that.
Okay.
I always thought it was interesting, though, that during that whole controversy, I don't think anybody can question the orthodoxy of Pastor Baker in any way, shape, or form, especially if you've read, and I have, every article he ever did in the Truth magazine. But during that whole thing, the interesting and surprise to me is that Baker never opened his mouth. So far as I know, he never made any attempt whatsoever to confront Stan or Dean or any of those guys. It's two sides of it.
Well, I think that
Baker never took a stand, though he himself would no doubt have classed himself a fundamentalist in every sense of the word. He never took a stand against Dean.
There's letters coming in a future lesson, I can't remember if it's next week or the week after, where the two of them are co-authoring, Dean and Baker are co-authoring a letter together, of which you would read it and have the assumption or have the opinion or the mindset that they're together in what they're together in their perception of what Stan is doing. And I'll share that with you. So that's from like 67. We're still in 66. So I want you to see sort of the emerging nature of this argument. Yeah.
Well, I think that the spiritual condition on the front side, Catholic wedding and lack of discipline, I think all those kind of should be grouped together, because when a parent sends their kids to a Christian college, they're expecting that to help round them out as far as spiritually and deepen their walk. So he's probably seeing the fact that they would go to a Catholic wedding or that they weren't getting the discipline that they... Parents were probably expecting these sort of things, and if they weren't happening, I think they were concerned, because you send your kids to a Christian college because you feel it's a safe and edifying and learning experience for them. And
I understand what you're saying,
yeah.
But I don't perceive these as being any other... These are not unique concerns of Grace Bible College.
Right.
These would have been true of any Bible college,
right,
or Bible institute that a parent sends their kid to. That there's always some, you know, bad apples that are going to sow their wild oats and do what they're going to do. And I just don't think that that's fair necessarily to stick that in. Particularly when Stan himself used to have the responsibility of disciplining these students. So if there's anybody that should have known firsthand experience what that aspect of running the college was like, it should have been him, it seems to me. Okay.
Yes, there's a saying with students that we understand now that are older, they'll say, well, we can do that because Stan was dead.
Yeah.
I've heard that said a lot.
Stan was very much, you're going to do it the way that I say you're going to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. August 9, 1966, letter of David L. Weddle to C.R. Stan. So this is the author of The Spirit of Marianism now writing to Stan. So on August 9, 1966, David Weddle addressed a letter to Stan in response to a letter that Stan had sent to Dean. Okay? regarding the spring publication of Weddell's article, Spirit of Bereanism, in the Journal of Grace Theology. Among other things, Weddell took exception to Stamp's characterization of his article as, quote, a perversion of the context of Acts 17. Weddell is careful to note that if Stamp understood his article to be suggesting that one seek a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ outside of the pages of Scripture, that Stamp had misread his article. Moreover, Weddell claims that it is a misreading of his article to suppose that he supported the entire neo-evangelical agenda. So this is going to come up again too. Okay, so at some point, Vernon Schutz in an article in a letter is basically going to say, "Well, look, Catholics believe in the virgin birth of Christ, his crucifixion and resurrection. Does that make me a Catholic? Because I agree with them about that." Okay, so the idea there is I can be in agreement with a neo-evangelical on a few things. That doesn't make me a what? Neo-evangelical. That's what Weddell is basically getting at here. Okay, August 17, 1966. Letter David L. Weddell to Charles F. Baker. On August 17, 1966, Weddell addressed a letter to Baker regarding Farrell's... Let me start over. I messed this up. I didn't mess it up reading it. I messed it up in my mind as I was reading it. On August 17, 1966, David Weddell addressed a letter to Baker regarding Farrell's letter to Baker, as well as some concerns about Stamp. In this letter, Weddell explains to Baker what he meant by some of the more controversial statements in his article, namely his recommendation to consider Tillich's analysis of, quote, the God of popular theism concept. Beyond this, Weddell just defends the major suppositions of his article to Baker. September 7, let's go back just quick, I want to point something out about the bottom. The statement here where it says, Weddell explains to Baker what he meant by some of the more controversial statements. We're going to see next time we have class that Stamm, in a letter to DeWitt, says, only intellectuals write things and then have to explain later what they meant when they said things. So in other words, if Weddell's going to write an article, and he says something in the article, but he has to come along later and explain what he meant when he said it, he said, only intellectuals do that to try to escape the criticisms that they're receiving from what they wrote. Okay? So Stamm would view what Weddell's doing here as, you know, look, well, if this isn't what you meant, then why did you what?
Right.
Why'd you write it? Okay, yeah.
Well, if Weddell was addressing a letter to Baker concerning Farrell's letter to Baker, was these being published, or how
would... Oh, they were sharing these letters.
Okay.
There's no doubt that, in fact, in one letter I've seen, there are some pastors that even say to the college, upon receipt of this letter, I don't know if it was Xerox at that time, I don't know what they called it in the 60s, but duplicate it and send it out. In other words, boom, you get it out there because, you know, I want everybody to know what I think about this or what have you.
Okay.
Page 3. September 7, 1966, Roger Anderson to Dale DeWitt. On September 7, 1966, Roger Anderson, a later president of the GGF, I believe he was president in the 90s at the time, is that right, Lee?
Yes.
Addressed a letter to Dale DeWitt. In this letter, Anderson relates that it has come to his attention that DeWitt was suffering criticism for some of the comments he made at the 1966 GGF convention. In his letter, Anderson conveys the idea that he, Anderson, had warned DeWitt that something like this, i.e. controversy, would happen if they move forward with the journal. Okay? So Roger Anderson is saying, look, I warned you guys way back when that journal started that if you went forward with this, it was going to be trouble. And he says that he warned DeWitt about that personally in this letter. It is clear that Anderson viewed the controversy as a byproduct of, quote, men bucking to gain position in the GGF. End quote. While Anderson does not name names, he states the following, quote, "Those who speak the loudest," I think he has Sam in mind, about not wanting to be denominational type of thing, are the ones who insist on the control of what is happening, which is somewhat interesting perception. In many ways, we are more denominational than the denominations, end quote. What have I been saying about the GGF since we started talking about them? That for all intents and purposes, they were what? A denomination. Okay, and here's a guy that later becomes president saying, hey, look it, we're kidding ourselves if we don't think that we're functioning like the denominations function. He maybe didn't say it in so many words the way I just said it, but basically that's what he means. And then you go on, at the end of his letter, Anderson seems to ask whether or not grace extends to doctrine when he writes, quote, "We speak of grace, but we tend to be ungracious. May God give us all the grace to forgive one another and to work together in the spirit of it. May He also give us the grace to stick to our convictions while at the same time being more understanding of the convictions of another," end quote. So I find Roger Anderson's letter here to be interesting on a few levels. Number one, he points out that he's told DeWitt before the journal even started that if they move forward with this journal, there was going to be what? There's going to be controversy, okay? I think it's interesting that he says what he says about functioning as a denomination, and I also find it interesting what he says at the end about grace. Does grace extend to doctrine also? And to what degree are we to discuss without, you know, getting without disfellowshipping, I guess, would be a way to look at it. Any questions there? Okay. Fall 1966, in the folder, there was a document that had at the top of it, Fall 1966, and it said, suggested statement of the faculty to the college board. Okay? Contained within the files I went through in the Baltimore Library was what appears to have been a draft copy of a statement by the GBC faculty to the college board. There's a handwritten date at the top of it, circa fall 1966. There are also numerous other handwritten corrections and edits noted throughout the text. So I think what this is a statement on the part. It was a draft copy, it was passed around, it was edited, and then it was submitted to the college board. So this wasn't necessarily a letter that circulated, it was a statement on the part of the faculty of the college to the college board regarding what's beginning to emerge here with this controversy. The statement is written to express the views of the faculty regarding a list of 10 suggestions that had been sent to the board by Stamm and Farrell. It is apparent from the first paragraph that the faculty wished to impress upon the board that they were in agreement with the doctrinal statement both of the college and of the GGF. Quote, "When we sign our contracts each spring, we thereby also sign our affirmation to the college doctrinal statement and the GGF doctrinal statement. We do this voluntarily because we want to and not because we are being forced to. We recognize that this is a legitimate limitation of academic freedom, which we gladly accept. Realizing that as Christians, indeed as grace believers, we do not have total academic freedom and that we must work within the framework of the theological platform upon which we mutually agree." So they're saying, we agree with everything in the GGF doctrinal statement, which basically was exactly the same as the college doctrinal statement. Okay? So they're saying, as long as we're not deviating from the doctrinal statement, we should have what? Academic freedom. Okay? Regarding the charge of neo-evangelicalism at the college, the faculty stated, quote, "It is our conviction that many of the items included under the concept neo-evangelicalism are problems which press themselves upon the Church of Jesus Christ as a result of the last 50 to 75 years of American church history. Particularly these problems grow out of an attempt of the true people of God to relate themselves to the world in which they live. Consequently, it would be unwise to force a commitment to a certain political philosophy, a certain mode of evangelism, a certain translation of the Bible, a certain view of cooperation with other evangelical believers, a certain view of the church's social function in the world, etc. We believe, on the contrary, that a firm affirmation of enthusiastic and wholehearted, unreserved commitment to the doctrinal statement as received should be continued as a policy, and that this commitment is sufficient for the entire faculty administration. Now, before I say anything, how do you understand that statement? Because I have an understanding, and I want you to hear from you. See if you're understanding the same way I am. Ronnie?
Whatever you didn't have the foresight to put into your doctrinal statement is up for grabs.
Anybody agree with that?
Yes.
Greg? Basically, yes. If it's not prohibited in the doctrinal statement, if the doctrinal statement doesn't say you can only, you know, you have to be conservative or you have to be liberal or you have to do this or that or the other thing, then anything that is not outlined or delineated in that statement, we therefore possess what? Freedom with respect to those issues. Okay? Everybody understanding that? Yes?
That was a problem all the way across the board throughout Christianity at that time.
Yes.
Because of the inspiration of Scripture not having been an issue before then, and therefore not hammered out in doctrinal statements.
Or at least not for a long time, yeah.
Yeah.
So in the face of the controversy, the faculty sought to stress the following points. Okay? I did? Oh, I'm sorry. The faculty clearly viewed themselves as being, quote, intimidated into accepting the views of Farrell and Stamp. Quote, we suspect that the opposition is an attempt to force the private views of some of the problem areas suggested above on the faculty in the name of orthodoxy. We further suspect that the pressure to do so, since it includes threats of public exposure on the parts of Messrs. Stamm and Farrell, constitutes an attempt at intimidating the board of the faculty into such a position. We wholeheartedly support a refusal to succumb to this kind of intimidation. Look, I think there's two ways to look at this. Okay? I don't think it's necessarily correct for Stamm and Farrell to be submitting the college to this type of blackmail. I don't think that's gracious or spiritual that they would be conducting themselves in that way. But you have to look at it from the other side too, that from the point of view of the faculty, they are definitely parsing an argument here to support what they perceive to be their academic freedom to be able to explore other realms of thought as long as nothing they say contradicts the doctrinal statement of the school. Okay? I don't know if anybody sees it differently. If you do, I'm certainly willing to hear your comments on it. So this is a mess. Is really what it is. Okay. In the face of the controversy, the faculty sought to stress the following points. Quote, we commit ourselves without reservation to the statement on the verbal inspiration and plenary authority of the Scriptures. We go so far as to desire to add the word inerrant to the definition of Scripture since modern theological discussions, the term verbally inspired, has taken on a certain vagueness, especially in the light of neo-orthodoxy, which is what you were getting at a minute ago, Ronnie. We believe that the walk of the Christian is of great importance, and we commit ourselves unreservedly to a responsible appropriation of the power of Christ for victory over sin. And though the statement says nothing about separation from the world, we believe and practice that the Christian should constantly be experiencing the cleansing of the spirit of separation from the spirit of worldliness. We gladly, on the principle of limiting Christian freedom for the well-being of the whole people of God, restrict our liberty as suggested to us by the board during the summer months. So, the board had clearly said, given them some directives as a result of the emerging controversy, even though they don't explicitly state what they are here. We further affirm that to require us to believe certain philosophies of the relationship of the church to other concerns is an undue and unnecessary imposition on our Christian liberty. We affirm, therefore, that any added requirements related to our views of evangelism, cooperation, translation versions, social problems, etc., must be firmly resisted. Specifically, if a faculty member holds certain views on methods of evangelism, we believe that is his own business. We also maintain that it is his right as a faculty member to hold these views and to teach them as long as there is not inherent contradiction with the platform to which we have committed ourselves. That's about as clear as you can get about what they're saying. Okay? Lee.
Yeah. That comment there about verbal inspiration, a careful observation of what's going on within the Christian community as of the hour is that that phrase, verbal inspiration, has been almost 100% removed. If you look at very few believe today or will publicly say they believe in verbal inspiration.
What are they? What would they call it then?
Well, you'll find, I'm saying it's not there. They dropped the term verbal, which gives itself then to dynamic equivalent.
They'll use the word infallible. That way they can get around. They can still deny that Genesis is the first 11 chapters are historical, but still the Bible is true in matters of faith and salvation.
Okay.
But to call it verbal is shunned.
I'm sure that you could look at that as. Are you suggesting that that's a byproduct of this new evangelical stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. What page are we on? Any other comments about any of this, Craig? I see you back there shaking your head. I know you've got. Oh, okay. So, then on top of, including within that document, on top of page 5, there's a statement, we should like to specify several particular areas in which this liberty should be maintained. Okay? Number one, one's views of methods of evangelism. Number two, one's views on sources of truth. Now think about this. What did Wells say in his article? He said that that a true Berean is open to additional sources from which new truth what? Arises. When they say that, are they basically supporting the premise of much of what Weddle said in his argument? Okay? So hopefully you're thinking about that with me as we go through this. Third, one's views on church music. Fourth, one's views on modern versions of the Bible. Five, one's views on cooperation with other evangelicals. Six, one's views on the role of the church in society. The GGF statement wisely avoids dogmatic statements on this point. Why do you think they included that in parentheses? One's views on political issues and contemporary social problems. One's views on the place of scholarship in the Christian academic community. So they're saying that they should have freedom with respect to all those issues so long as nothing they have to say about any of those issues violates the doctrinal statement of the school and the GGF. Okay? I just want you to understand here, what are they saying? Okay, that's the point. Yes?
I might tend to agree with these in terms of one's views, but at the college, what they are demanding is the liberty to impose these views on the young students that are sent to them.
I think that's true. We have in this assembly all sorts of different, views about certain subjects. You know, there One of them would be, you know, how should we understand Genesis 1? There are some that would advocate for a gap theory. There are others that are opposed to a gap theory. So the idea being, you should give people the right to be fully persuaded in their own mind. Where you run into trouble is, what are they teaching the students with respect to these things? So if they want to have individual liberty to believe what they want to believe, I don't know, it'd be hard to say, no, you can't have liberty to believe what you want to believe. The problem comes in is, now we got students sitting in front of us, and are we teaching our personal views as just options, or are we teaching them as fact? That's where you start to have problems, Tom.
It's just, maybe other people kind of seeing the same thing, but when you read some of the language in there, they're really stressing their individual liberty to be able to do something. When that seems dichotomous with the concept of the college as an agent of a larger group, and therefore you would, you know, subjugate some of your personal thoughts to whatever it was that the organization above you was dictating.
Yeah. But they're going to say, well, we're doing that because we're limiting ourselves by what's recorded in the doctrinal statement.
Right. I see that, but they seem so fierce on this idea of liberty. And you've got members of your organization that are saying, hey, you should be doing this.
So what you end up with is a situation where you say, we haven't violated the doctrinal statement, so we should be able to do this. Right? I mean, isn't that basically what's going on here?
Right. It just seems a little almost silly.
Okay. Anyone else? Fred?
Looking at an example in reverse, or you're a public school teacher, right?
Yep.
Are you allowed to teach creationism?
Shut the camera off, Norm.
Are you allowed to teach creationism in public school? Even though you hold that as your personal conviction.
If the kids ask me what I think, I can answer, tell them what my opinion is. So I can teach my class in such a way to as to prompt them to ask me that question. Are you following what I'm saying? I mean, I understand what they're doing here. Okay? Because to some degree, I do that myself. I cover more stuff about God and creation and religious things in my philosophy class than most people would ever dream of being discussed in a public school. Because we can discuss things in that class, and if they ask me questions, I can say, and what I do this is this, Fred. They'll ask me a question, I say, so you're asking me my opinion. Yes, Mr. Ross, I'm asking you your opinion. Okay, then my opinion is this. And I tell them what it is. Now, I don't teach it as, you know, God's absolute truth and fact like we do here at church. But I can answer that question and say, this is what I think and why I think it. And so, as a Christian educator, I do teach my class on purpose to try to prompt as many of those types of questions as I can from the students. Now, am I unethical or immoral? I don't know.
No, Brett, I'm not saying it that way. But my point is that these guys, if this faculty has different personal convictions from what the
constituency of the school,
yeah, is they could do the same thing.
Yeah, of course.
So they could switch it around and give their opinions, you know, prompt students to ask their opinions
about things.
Yeah.
But it sounds like they aren't wanting to do that, but they're demanding that they have the right to teach whatever they believe, as long as it's not in the doctrinal statement.
I would agree that that's my understanding of what they're saying. So in other words, you're going to have to alter, if you don't want us to teach such, you're going to have to change the doctrinal statement with a statement about such. Otherwise, we're free to teach as we see fit.
Okay.
That's the way I understand what they're saying. Yeah.
A number of years ago, I was in a Lutheran women's Bible study, and they were studying the book of Daniel and Revelation. And the pastor apparently himself was dispensational in the matter. And the ladies kept asking him, because he would present a number of views, and the ladies kept asking him, which of these views do you believe? And he would always say, well, your church teaches that. But then he continued to teach the rest of the things. He wouldn't ever actually say, but he wanted us to see all of the possibilities.
I think personally, this is just my own personal, private, subjective opinion about this stuff, that real education will teach all sides of an issue. If you're talking about education outside of a local church, so public school education, it's not real education to only teach evolution as the only option that there is. That's not educating, even according to the paradigm of the liberal arts. Okay, that's not education in a secular sense. Okay. Now, I certainly wouldn't say that, but even within the local church, if I'm gonna teach mid-ex Pauline dispensationalism, is there any value to me also explaining what an Acts 2 person believes and an Acts 28 person believes? I would say yes, because as I think we've seen in this class, that's how O'Hare got to where he was. He was here. He was here. Oh my word! None of these. I don't think either one of these are right. And in thinking it through, he ends up in the middle. So I think there's value to understanding that which you don't agree with from the point of view of strengthening why you believe what you agree with, I guess would be the way I would answer that. But again, how are you going to do that? That's the thing. Norm, was your hand up?
Well, if really wasn't, you must have saw me thinking or something. I remember a deputy used to tell me, you know, he presented all these things to me when I knew him. And he said, I'm going to tell you something. You don't even believe what I tell you. He says, because the word is the filter, you know.
Yeah.
And that was it.
And I think that's the point that is lost in all this. And that's Stam's fundamental point. It doesn't matter what some egghead in a university says. What does the Bible say? You know, what does the Bible say, understood, rightly divided, and so on? So let's summarize this point and then get to the conclusion, and then if there's any other questions or comments, we'll talk about them. So in summation, the faculty of GBC, now this is as of the fall of 1966, the faculty of GBC did not deny that even neo-evangelical thinking had been embraced to varying degrees by some of the school's faculty. They don't deny that. In fact, I would argue they're asking for permission or freedom to entertain it to whatever degree it won't contradict the doctrinal statement. Okay? So when Stam says that neo-evangelicalism is making headway at the college, is he totally wrong? I would say no. So let me read that again. In summation, the faculty of GBC did not deny that neo-evangelical thinking had been embraced, now this is important, to varying degrees by some of the school's faculty. Rather, they argue that they ought to be allowed to maintain their, quote, academic freedom so long as they were not teaching doctrines directly contrary to the doctrinal statement of GBC or the GGF. By framing the conversation in this fashion, the faculty of the college sought to maintain the school's historic stance for dispensational theology in general, and the theology of the grace movement specifically, while embracing various other aspects of the neo-evangelical platform. In short, to varying degrees, the faculty could be seen as embracing a modified version of neo-evangelicalism minus the prohibition against dispensational theology. This nuanced argument is something that Stam never completely understood. Okay? So, I'm going to be Stam. You guys are neo-evangelicals. Okay? The college. Yeah, but we're not anti-dispensational. You see what's going on? They're not denying that that amongst the faculty there has been an embracing of certain points of neo-evangelicalism. They don't deny that. In fact, I would argue when you look at what these liberties are seeking to maintain, they're seeking to maintain liberty with respect to some of the very issues that were being raised by the neo-evangelicals. Okay? So they're over here saying we're not neo-evangelicals because we're not anti-dispensational. Stan's over here saying what? You can't be a neo-evangelical without being what? Anti-dispensational. So the college is maintaining, and they would maintain to this day, that they have never not been Pauline dispensationalists.
They say what they want.
Okay? They will say that. Stan's point of view, as he's looking at them, he's saying, look it, you guys are, you're embracing this, that, the other thing, you're doing these things that we've looked at in the last 2 weeks. Neo-evangelicalism has gained a foothold in the college, and the college's perspective is, we're still dispensational, we're still maintaining our stance with respect to the doctrinal statement, but we're requiring freedoms in these categories right here. Okay? Conclusion. By the end of 1966, the GGF was embroiled in a controversy that centered on its only approved institution of higher learning, Grace Bible College. Judging from Stam's comments and silence now would be sin, it would be fair to say that he had been having misgivings about GBC for some time, possibly as early as 1964. In a recent phone conversation with Dr. Dale DeWitt that took place Thursday, November 14, 2013, he shared with me that Stam had been the guest speaker at the college for a series of lectures called the O'Hare Lectures in the first half of the 1960s, probably either 1962 or 63. DeWitt described Stam's reception by the students and faculty as cold at best. The spring 1966 article by Weddle in the Journal of Grace Theology seemed to be something of a last straw for Stam and Farrell. In the summer 1966 GGF convention, the private misgivings regarding the college and its leadership began to morph into public grumbling and criticism. Shortly after the 1966 convention, Farrell addressed his letter to Baker, an action that DeWitt characterized as the first shot across the bow. Pastoring in the Chicagoland area, there is little doubt that Stam and Farrell had spoken prior to Farrell drafting his letter and sending it to Baker. As news spread through the Grace Grapevine, you like that? That's my word, Grace. Through the Grace Grapevine of the controversy, an exchange of spirited letter writing emerged, which did not calm the situation. Top of page 6. By the end of 1966, clear sides were emerging in the conflict. Stam and Farrell and their supporters were pitted against Baker and Dean and their supporters. One of the primary bones of contention was the incursion of neo-evangelicalism and intellectualism into the Grace movement and its perceived acceptance by the faculty of GBC. The faculty's suggestions related to the board, drafted in the fall of 1966, present a nuanced argument that would allow for the exception of any viewpoint that was not in direct violation of the college's doctrinal statement. As the calendar turned to 1967, the controversy did not subside, but burned ever hotter, as we shall see in our next lesson. All right. Any questions, comments, or feedback? Yeah.
I think this whole thing in this college is a mistake from the get-go. I think what they should have done is thrown out the doctrinal statement and the ruse of being a mid-act dispensational college, because what they're doing is they're summoning parents and you don't know what's going on here, thinking they're going to a doctrinally safe place, and they're not at all. I think the mistake was trying to say that you're mid-acts and you're just we're supposed to be different from the world and the rest of Christianity. And what they're doing is they're trying to be like the rest of the world and the rest of Christianity. And I think the whole thing was just a recipe for disaster from the beginning, and it's just a big move.
The situation certainly is much more difficult than you may have realized when we started this, okay? And this is the part where I sort of have my hot collar here, okay? Because my goal is not here to try to inflame people and situations. It's to understand what happened and why it happened, which I don't think has been done adequately heretofore.
How much of this, it seems to me that the times of the 60s must have been an influence there also.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
And the kids were coming from different places. I mean, given Chicago had its own things going on in the 60s.
I'll just say this in response to Craig's point. You can say on a piece of paper that you're about whatever you want to say you're about on the piece of paper. But just because you say you're about something doesn't mean that in the practicality of what you're doing you actually are. Okay? I went to the school, and to graduate, I had to take theology classes where they did teach dispensational theology. Okay? There was a lot of other stuff in there, too, that did not always, in my opinion, support what the stated goal of what was going on was supposed to be. Okay? That's my perception, having been there. Okay? Fred?
Back on that list, on top of page 5, if you take that list now into 2013, you could include them there, say, like, second one from the bottom says, one's views on political issues and contemporary social problems. So it doesn't matter whether you agree with gay marriage or not, I mean...
So if the doctrinal statement doesn't say we recognize marriage between one man and one woman, then that'd be okay, based on that logic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the problem with not having those absolutes is that you move with the times, you become conformed to the issues of the day rather than being transformed by the...
And I can say to you that there were, even when I was there, there were certain faculty members that embraced and promoted evolution because and felt that it was academic freedom to do that because it didn't violate the Constitution, didn't violate the doctrinal statement. Okay? So this nuanced argument is going to lead to more things even than what are stated here in the statement from 66. Okay. So, any other thoughts or comments? Lee?
I just think that, based on my observation, the conflict between, for example, spam and the school, but I don't think you can write Dale DeWitt out of that controversy. Dale, like spam, is as hard-headed and unbending as any man could be. I happened to be at a board meeting where Dale was over the issue of evolution. Dale's a committed, he's not an atheistic or a theistic evolutionist, he's a progressive.
Creationist.
Yeah, creationist. And he was censured. He was censured by the board. In fact, Dr. Dean was one of the ones. I was there with Dr. Dean, confronted him, and Clarence Cramer. Again, there was that tension there, but it was never resolved. It didn't change Dale or what he thought one bit over that. But that was just one of the issues. Dale was always throwing something in. I don't know whether it was just a technique to get the kids to think or whether he actually believed a lot of the stuff that he thought.
Well, having sat in the class, I would say that he believed it. I mean, I had a, my own. I had a discussion with him in class publicly about continuing creationism, and you know why I objected to that concept. So this nuanced argument is just like doing this. It's sort of like throwing open the door to anything that's not going to violate the doctrinal statement. So what you end up with then is, okay, we have a piece of paper over here that says this is what we're... And we're even teaching some of that stuff still. But then a bunch of other stuff has come in that doesn't support necessarily or bolster or fit with some, you know, with what are supposed to be the basic tenets of why we exist. So, just, yeah, last comment, Ronnie, go ahead.
From a purely historical, not even just zoning in on the church, from a purely historical perspective, has anybody written anything yet that really figures out what it is that caused what happened in the 60s? I mean, there's all sorts of things that were used as the scapegoat, but it's almost like an intentional plan of evil that infiltrated everywhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that have been written about this, okay? One of the most intriguing, which I think has one of the most intriguing explanations of what's happened, is based upon a... Now, I'm going to tell you this. I'm not saying that I subscribe to this, okay? Based upon a generational understanding of history, okay, that at any time in the life of a nation, you have four generations in existence. You have a generation that's 0 to 20, you have a generation that's 21 to 40, you have a generation that's 41 to 60, a generation that's 61 to 80, and then anybody over 80 is called late elderhood. Okay? So this is childhood, this is young adulthood, this is midlife, and this is elderhood. Okay? And so what happens is you have, upon posing, and this cycle lasts roughly 70 to 80 years, the equivalent of a human life. Okay? And that at opposing end of this, you have a crisis, and down here you have an awakening. Okay? And that that history runs according to this stroke, this rhythm, this rhythmic stroke within the life of a nation. Okay? And then you have four seasons. You have winter. Winter is your crisis season. Spring, summer, and fall. Okay? And where somebody is born in relationship to either the crisis or the awakening determines the generational mindset of the people that fit into that age group. Okay? What's going on in the 1960s is this. The thing that happens about this awakening that makes it different from every other awakening in the history of the United States is that it's the first awakening without the God of the Bible being a part of it. If you think back to the previous spiritual awakenings that occurred in the country, they were not obviously mid-Acts driven or Pauline driven, but they were God driven, if you will, or Bible driven by people that at least respected the Scriptures. Okay, so this is one way that some historians have tried to understand this. Okay, so as people move through the cycle of the nation, but each group, so for example, Ronnie, if there's a war, this generation grows up with the war, this generation fights the war, this generation plans the war, and this generation tells everybody what they remember about the last war. Okay? And so, as the clock turns within the life of a nation, you move through this sequential pattern. Right now, that's where we're at. According to this model, we're in the winter time of crisis right now in the country. The question is going to, and think about it, you know, there are a lot of interesting things to consider. The last crisis before this one was the dual crisis of the Depression and World War II. The next awakening is the social awakening of the 60s and the 70s. Right? So, the people that were born here during this era are the ones that are coming of age here that are creating all the problems. When was the heyday of the grace movement? During the crisis. We have to stand resolute with our message in the middle of the crisis.
Amen.
Okay? You don't change the message during the crisis, because when do people need the message the most? It's in the middle of a crisis. Now look, you know, you can go to the Bible and you can talk about fall, spring, winter, summer in Genesis. You can talk about everything there is a season. I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily scripturally backed. Okay? But it is definitely an interesting thing to consider, and it helps, it might give you some framework to answer that question around. So when you brought up last week about why can't these men talk to each other without seemingly it being the end of the world, part of it is a result of this generational mindset that they have. Each one of these generations then falls into an archetype of an identity that they have based upon where they're born with respect to even the awakening of the crisis. Okay? And that follows them through the rest of their tenure in the cycle. Who's running the country now? It's the boomers. It's all of those kids that were born in that generation immediately following the last what? And it's the same ones that were leading the craziness of the 60s and the 70s. And now, Norm, sorry if that's you, okay? So, but now they're in the pop. This is the power stroke of life. Here you're learning. Here you're beginning to forge an identity as an adult. And here is where you begin to, you enter your power phase of life when in your 40s. There is very little respect given to somebody in any professional, in the professional world who is under 40. Okay, we got to quit, but yeah.
When I was a little girl, I was being raised in the 50s and 60s and going to grade school and high school during that time. And what blew up in the 60s, I perceive as my teachers, who were 21 to 40 at that time, were the ones who planted all of that. And I really think they planted it for the whole boomer generation.
Yeah, because they, so all that has, all of this has an effect then on the next cycle.
Yes, they were constantly from the day we entered kindergarten telling us how we were going to change the world. And how the old was absolutely outmoded.
And that's where you get postmodernism. We've gone beyond science. You know, so, but we got to quit. Appreciate the conversation.